This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, diving beneath the headlines of one of the biggest stories of the week, and beneath those headlines, deadlines. They are everywhere, from Capitol Hill to Beacon Hill. Some priorities, like the budget, and as of this morning, abortion, look like they will clear the docket, but others could still face the chopping block. Think sports betting.
I think there's an opportunity to include college sports rather than let it be only handled by bookies.
I would hope and I would ask that the speaker not take an all-or-nothing approach.
Meanwhile, more hate in Boston streets, and the clock is ticking to do more about that.
People deserve to feel comfortable where they live, where they worship.
But whose job is it to protect that safety?
We need to have a greater focus nationally on how these groups can be tracked and monitored and categorized as verging on domestic terrorism.
You heard State House Speaker Ron Mariano there, and then State Senate President Karen Spilka, U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Rachel Rollins, and Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, all three speaking to us here on Radio Boston this week. Here to help us put everything in perspective, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, and Joe Battenfeld, columnist for the Boston Herald. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
So I do want to give a quick nod. We had anticipated and planned to have Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley on with us today overnight. They're facing looming deadlines as well. New votes got called. She wasn't able to join us. So let's just touch on that for a second. What is most important to you, Tito Jackson, to see our congressional delegation get accomplished for us, ASAP?
I think blasting through healthcare, getting a hold of our economy, and ensuring that we are, as a country, on the right footing. And obviously, transportation bill would also be one that I would love to see.
Joe Battenfeld, any of that match your list?
I think climate change is a big one for Democrats, and it looks like there was a little breakthrough on that. And so it's possible they could get it done, but we still don't know that for sure because we still have the holdout. But that could be big for Democrats if that passes.
All right. So the biggest story of the week had a lot of moving pieces to it. We were going to start with the budget, but we're not now, because as of this morning, we've been watching for this. We found that Governor Charlie Baker has signed the abortion bill, the abortion protections bill that was put on his desk. And that included some question marks around whether he would support a language that provided for 24 post-24 week abortions in certain cases. I'm going to read you the language as it went to the governor's desk. In case of a lethal fatal anomaly or diagnosis or grave fetal diagnosis that indicates that the fetus is incompatible with sustained life outside of the uterus without extraordinary medical interventions. Now, just for listeners, Roe Act in 2020, Governor Baker vetoed just the part that said lethal fatal anomalies. The legislature overrode that. There was a lot of question about whether he'd sign this. Joe Battenfeld, are you surprised that he did?
No, I'm not surprised. He was under a lot of pressure to sign this from Democrats and from some in his own party. And I think if they had left the language as originally it was, I don't think he would have signed it. I think it was the House version that was a little
looser. The House version had the word severe.
Right.
And the Senate said, we don't like that.
Right. They were afraid it would apply to cases like Down syndrome. So I think there was definitely a question whether he would have signed that. But when they changed it, I think it opened the door.
So to pick up on that, Tito Jackson, here's a little sound from Senate President Karen Spilka talking with us this week about this question of the word severe.
The word severe was totally unclear. And despite asking what does it mean, the Senate never got a response what its definition was. So how do we expect doctors or providers or people to interpret what it meant?
And I want to underscore, Tito Jackson, that what she was explaining to us was that the law as written, she felt that medical providers were not complying because they felt their flank was too exposed by the confusing nature or the lack of clarity in the language. So let's pick that thread.
And I think that's important. It's, as a legislator, it's actually really important to listen to the individuals who are experts in the space, and in particular in the healthcare space. I used to work in the healthcare space. So I think that is a really critical component. I also think that it is important that Massachusetts lead and not follow when it comes to the issues of the right of women to have an abortion, but also this component that a woman and her doctor have that opportunity to make this decision. So I think it's absolutely the right decision. We need to continue to lead the country, in particular at this important time. And I would note that this is a very important issue for me. I am actually my birth would have been one of the things that would essentially been contested in this regard. I am the product of a rape. And I still believe in my heart of hearts that women should have the right to choose. And we must, as a state, lead in this regard.
And I do want to flag for our listeners, and we can put this link up on our website. We've had some pretty interesting conversations with you about your history and what you've learned about your birth. And I appreciate you sharing that again today. And we can link to some of the really amazing past conversations we've had with you. Joe Battenfeld, I'll come back over to you. I was really intrigued to hear you say that Governor Baker faced pressure from Democrats, but also inside his own party. Because in the context of the battle we're seeing in the state GOP between a faction that probably would be quite not pleased with the governor for signing
this,
talk a little bit more about that pressure inside his own party you're talking
about.
Yeah,
I may have been unclear. I meant pressure from conservatives to not sign it.
Got it.
Right. Okay. And he was
that makes a lot more sense, Joe.
Yeah, no, sorry about that.
That's
confusion.
Right.
But there is a faction in the GOP that's still pro-choice. But for the most part, it's, you know, conservatives did not want to sign. They'd given up on Baker a long time ago. So I don't think they're surprised that he signed this now. But it's just yet another issue that they're going to use against him.
So you expect to see great displeasure show up, for example, in the Republican gubernatorial primary?
Probably, although they're not trying to make abortion like the number one issue in this state. They're trying to focus on the economy and inflation and things like that. So, but I do expect there to be a little pushback, yeah.
So, Teeter Jackson, I want to pick up one more thing on this before we move on to other key parts of our big segment in review this week, which is all about looming deadlines to get stuff done. Actually, I just distracted myself as I was saying that and lost in my head here it is. So when we talked to State Senate President Karen Spilka earlier this week, one of the things that she really wanted to underscore was that this bill also had a range of other protections for providers, et cetera, really all framed around building, my words, not hers, some kind of defensive wall around the ability to provide abortion services in the Commonwealth when other states have demonstrated the desire to reach into the state and prosecute from outside. How important and how effective are those pieces? Have we done enough if that's the goal?
I think we need to be vigilant. I think there has been movement there, and essentially there needs to be a force field around the providers in the state of Massachusetts, as well as all of the states who are continuing to provide at the state level these reproductive services for women. And to your point, one of the strategies that have been used by those who are anti-abortionists have been to sue individuals in other states. And I think as recently as this week, this case around a 10-year-old
who was a victim of rape in Ohio and had to go to Indiana in order to receive abortion care.
Right. And so there's back and forth as to one, whether or not that was true. And we know that there are now charges against an individual around that. But also the physician who participated in this is now being looked at by, I believe, the Attorney General of Indiana.
I think it's Indiana. You took me far afield today,
yeah,
Tito. Yeah. Maybe we can have somebody check that for us.
Yeah, exactly. So I think overarching this, it is critical that the state legislature here, as well as the governor, as they move forward on doing the right thing for the people of Massachusetts, we also do need to make sure that we are doing the right thing by the providers who are courageously doing this work on a day-to-day basis.
All right. So we are having Indiana Attorney General is investigating the doctor. Thanks, folks. I appreciate that. So listen, we're having a conversation here, diving beneath the headlines on legislative deadlines, which doesn't sound sexy, but is actually super, super important. And with us are Teeter Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and Joe Battenfeld, who's a Boston Herald columnist now. I'm going to transition here, and I cannot resist this. As we move to the question of the budget, this has been playing in my head all week. Now, that's, of course, For the Love of Money by the OJs. It's got a kind of groove that I don't feel we hit in the process of trying to put together a $53 billion budget, which is nearly 10% more than the last one. Governor Baker signed it with some amendments just yesterday. And here he is touting a little portion of it, saying that basically, hey, we can afford this.
This budget contains about $1 billion in one-time spending, which involves a whole series of transfers to reserves, pilot programs, pandemic recovery initiatives. We believe it's affordable. We believe it's appropriate given the time we're in.
That's at the signing yesterday. Joe Battenfeld, do you agree? Appropriate? Anything you would have added or said no to?
I think there is concern that this kind of spending is going to trigger more inflation, but from Republicans at least. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I think, you know, Baker has been pretty chummy with the Democrats on these issues, on these budget issues. He only vetoed, I think, about 400 or 700 million, something like that, out of the entire budget.
So more than 400 range.
400 million.
Yeah, in that range.
Very minor, very minor. And so he's been going along with Democrats pretty much on this all along. Now there is concern because of this 1986 law that's come up. I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but the law that would trigger big tax rebates for, you know, Massachusetts residents, whether that could affect, you know, the tax cuts that they're talking about in the rest of the budget.
Oh, I am so glad you brought that up. And, you know, talk about money, money, money. So we have this law from the 1980s. Only been triggered once before, which is 1987. It has the governor saying that taxpayers could be due basically a refund of nearly $3 billion, that number being reported by the Boston Globe. It's a formula, and it basically says, Tito Jackson, that we can't collect money at a rate, like we can't increase the money we collect at a rate that is faster than wages and salaries grow. It's, you know, we can't get greedy. But everyone seemed to be pretty surprised that 1987 showed up and wanted its money back. Tito, what do you think?
I was also surprised, and, you know, $3 billion is a lot of money. And in this context, obviously, we have additional funds that came from ARPA as well.
American Rescue Plan Act.
And so that is it's really funny because I had a conversation with Aaron Michaelwitz probably 2 years ago, and he is the Ways and Means Chair. And it looked like he was about to cry because they had a $5 billion estimated gap.
This was in 2020.
Right?
Yeah.
At that time. And now, and I saw him the other day, I said, hey, it's a little bit different, right? And so you are probably on the $5 million upside when it comes to things. So I think there are strategic things that can and should happen. Roads, rails, and bridges. In the state of Massachusetts, schools, and I'll speak about the Boston Public Schools, 2/3 of the physical school buildings in Boston Public Schools were built before 1945. There's a lot of work that we need to do there. And then also there were unfunded mandates, such as the education bill that was signed a couple of years ago, but actually didn't have funds attached to it. So I think this is a responsible budget. I believe it's a sustainable budget. And also I think we are in a good place relative to reserves, which will allow us to move forward with some protections if we do have an economic downturn.
So Joe Battenfeld, if you feel like you're in a position to do it, I'm going to ask you to play math teacher a little bit here and explain to us a little bit more.
Professor Joe.
Professor Joe. The work that the legislature is doing on tax breaks, right? So what's the chunk that they're talking about roughly? And you said this could lead to some questions around that. Can you just explain that a
little
bit?
They're talking about giving rebates to people right now of like $250 to $500 per family.
But based on income thresholds that
yes.
are right.
Yes, and there was concern that they didn't include the lower of the lowest income.
Family incomes under $38,000 a year.
In that. So there was some concern about that. And now there is concern that because of this 1980s law, that they're going to be giving too much back to, you know, because Democrats, you got to watch Democrats on this one because they're not happy with that 1980s law. And they might try to monkey around with that and try to change that a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if there is an effort there behind the scenes to do that.
Based on the article I read this morning, because this is new, and so I'm going to give props to the Boston Globe on this. That's the one that I was reading this morning. We could be looking at a situation where instead of $250 for people above $38,000 but below a certain income level, everybody's getting something around $250 in a rebate because of this give back, Tito Jackson.
And I believe it's important that those individuals on the lowest end of the spectrum share in this. And I think I believe the governor used the word windfall. That windfall obviously disproportionately, I believe, should go to those on the lowest end, because that actually is going to help them the most, in particular in these times when people are making decisions about gas, rent, and food. And so I think that is also something that we need to be thoughtful about when it comes to how these dollars get spread.
Whereas a flat rebate, Joe Battenfeld, isn't what we would call progressive, right?
No.
It just means, in fact, potentially, if you put more in, you might get more out.
Right, right. Those in higher incomes could be getting more, definitely. So there's concern about that from Democrats.
All right, so I want to shift gears on this a little bit. And this is Radio Boston you're listening to. We're doing our dive into the biggest story of the week, which is just a big fat old set of policy issues, because the state legislature calls it quits on Sunday. And let me just explain this a little bit. State legislature calls it quits on Sunday. Basically, the legislative session ends. They're getting lots of bills that they can to the governor, but the governor has 10 days to respond to bills, sign them, provide amendments, veto individual pieces. But if the legislature is out of session, then they get what they get and they don't get upset, basically the old preschool line. And I'm curious about this, Joe Battenfeld, because I learned from WBUR senior state house reporter Steve Brown this week that that is not a function of state law or the state constitution. That is a function of legislative rules and practice. Are they giving a lame duck governor a tremendous amount of power by creating this situation?
I don't know how much power. I still think the legislature rules the roost and is the most powerful, you know.
See what you did there with roost and duck, by the
yes.
way. That was pretty good. Sorry.
And so whatever Baker does, he may try to slip in a few things or cut a few things, but the legislature will just go back in a couple months and change it again. Probably, if they get a chance to. So I'm not sure how much power Baker really has on this. Temporarily he can do a few things. Like he did a few things already. Like he put some amendments in, like giving Boston a seat on the MBTA board, which is very important to Boston. It's a big gift to Michelle Wu. But I'm not sure others will feel the same way about that. But he's, I don't think they can override him on that one. So he can do a few things, you know, on the edges, I think.
So Boston City Councilor, former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, you've got experience with making laws, making legislation, regulations, et cetera. We've talked a couple of times with legislators in the last couple of weeks about how, and WBUR senior state host reporter Steve Brown talked about this on our air, that there's a strategy here that you wait until the end of the legislature session, because it's a bargaining tactic, right? It's like playing chicken, and you're like, hey, we're out of time, give me what I want, or, you know, I'll take my marbles and go home. What's your thought on the efficacy versus the risk of that in a situation like what we're looking at now?
And I think it's what you see every year. And I was joking the other day that this if you talk to some of my high school teachers, this might have been the way that I worked out my schoolwork at the time. Right? Is at the push it all to the very push it all to the very
that's
end.
That's just procrastination.
Hey. But I was very effective in that last month.
I don't think it was strategic.
And so, I obviously, it is what happens on an annual basis. And to your point, it actually has been very effective. And with this amount of, again, they have way more than they've ever been able to have in the past. And so I think you have a lot of folks who are actually going home very happy for their cities, towns, and even these smaller municipalities. So I think this is the strategy that has worked, will work. And as Joe noted, they still have an opportunity to have another bite at the apple to make modifications once this process is over. And I want to compliment the legislature for really rolling their sleeves up and doing what needed to happen in our state, and also to be being thoughtful in the most difficult economic times that we have seen throughout these COVID components.
All right, so we have here a former Boston City Councilor, Tito Jackson, who you just heard, and Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld, as we look at the deadlines facing the state legislature. Before we move on to another subject, one more thing, because one of the things that could face the chopping block is sports betting. The Senate and the House are negotiating. They're divided on whether or not to include college betting as part of a sports betting plan. I'm going to give you a little sound here. Here's State House Speaker Ron Mariano answering questions from WBUR senior State House reporter Steve Brown at a press conference on July 21st.
If we're going to do this, I think there's an opportunity to include college sports rather than let it be only handled by bookies. I mean, I don't understand if you're going to do sports betting, why you would leave out the Final Four, the bowl games, and the whole college football season. It just doesn't seem to me to be worth doing if you're going to leave those.
But if nothing gets passed, everything goes to the bookies, right?
That's the way it is now.
But then here's State Senate President Karen Spilka talking to us on Tuesday.
The speaker has said that he doesn't believe it's, if college betting isn't in it, there's no point in doing it. I would hope and I would ask that the speaker change that position and not take an all or nothing approach.
And Joe Battenfeld, I want to note her comments have caused some kerfuffle, especially in the sports world over the last couple of days. So straight up, Joe, include college or not?
She's not the most popular person on sports talk radio, that's
no,
for sure. And this is rare, but I agree with Mariano on this one, because I think this, you know, we have been way behind on sports betting as opposed to other states, you know, going way in front of us. We're losing a lot of tax money. And to not include college betting is just, you know, President Spilka just does not like sports betting. And so this is almost like a poison pill kind of thing, where she knows that the House does not want this, you know, is going to reject this. So it could torpedo the entire legislation.
I think of the song "More Money, More Problems."
When it comes to this,
but I think the huge issue here is, one, college has to be included if we're going to be serious about this actual topic, because there's so much money that flows through that. I would also say there had been parts of this legislation that I also think need to be revisited, because I would love to see bodegas and smaller businesses have an opportunity to participate rather than casinos, who I think are doing pretty well right now, and these large organizations. So I think spreading the wealth around is also another way that we could be more equitable and help some of the smaller businesses.
Okay, in the few minutes that we have left, Joe Battenfeld and Tito Jackson, I'm going to pivot, and there's no way not to do this a little clunkily, because this is just a hard subject. But this past weekend, neo-Nazis protested outside a drag queen story hour. It was Jamaica Plain. It's outside the Lauren Greenow House on Saturday. The drag performer Patty Bure, who was reading, joined us earlier this week, and in talking to us, she pushed back really hard on the tropes that were being advanced by the neo-Nazis who were there about predation. Here's Patty Bure.
I just want to say that I have never once requested to do a drag queen story hour event. I'm a drag performer full time. So Drag Queen Story Hour is a great way to supplement my income, and I get many, many requests to do this. There's churches, museums, libraries that want, you know, drag performers to come and read to kids.
And Joe Battenfeld, Bore brought in her ukulele, played a little for us, and was explaining that somebody with a flair for drama and performance can really capture kids, right, and help them engage with stories. Of course, this comes in the context of a rising tide of hate and pushback against the LGBTQ community. I'm thinking about the horrible graffiti on the Pride development in Hyde Park back in June. Reaction from you to when this unfolded over the weekend?
I mean, when I saw that, as despicable as the neo-Nazis are and their views, you can't prevent them from staging a peaceful protest under our laws, under our Constitution. And unfortunately, they specifically target things like Drag Queen Story Hour, because that's, you know, they're going after what they view as, you know, is totally wrong. But I think it's putting pressure on these cities that are facing this to keep the peace. And there's a lot of tension. There was a lot of tension at that protest. And you know, it's just, I just fear that things will get out of control a little bit.
So Tito Jackson, picking up on, you know, Joe's point that there is a difference between your First Amendment right to demonstrate and hate crimes and violent activity. I'm going to give you a little bit of a quote from Rachel Rollins in her statement responding to what happened on Saturday. Quote, every single person has a right to live their life fully and authentically as who they are. But if your authentic self is a bigot that wants to harm, humiliate, and terrorize people, you are not welcome here. There is no hierarchy as to who is entitled to a full and authentic life, end quote. Now, Rollins went on to say, I'm going to open a hotline where you can call in. There will be those who say that creates a surveillance state and others who say that is the intelligence that we've been asking for. Where do you come down on this line, Tito?
I come down on an equitable approach to this. I believe that U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins is spot on. Look at the surveillance that has happened around Black Lives Matter, right? And so these individuals, we need to know who they are. And by the way, they're not extra. I don't believe this is simply an exercise of their First Amendment rights. They are bullies.
Although I don't know that Joe was saying that.
No. And I wasn't. But I think it gets dumbed down to that level. They are there to intimidate, harass, and make people feel unwelcome. And so, and by the way, I do need to, and we didn't have this word when I was a young person, but this is intersectionality, because these are the same people who were abusing a Black man in the Back Bay. It comes from the same place.
So you're referring to the white supremacy, and I'm not using the organization names on purpose, but you're referring to the white supremacy march in the city of Boston over the 4th of July weekend.
Yes. And so I just want to make that connection. And I think it is critical that people of conscience and that people who truly love the city and the people of the city, that we stand up, that we show up. And as Joe noted, not in a violent fashion, but we have to, at this point, have each other's back. And also, we need to have our share of voice about what we want our city to be, look like, feel like, and be about. And so I think there's the biggest opportunity right now. And when people think about what they can do, you need to show up for your neighbors. Be it individuals from the LGBTQIA community, be it individuals from the Asian Pacific Islander community, as well as the Black community in our city.
All right. I want to thank you both. I learned a lot. You both gave me a lot to think about. We just heard Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and also Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald columnist. Great to have you both in studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Joe.
Thank you, Professor Joe.
A plague! On both your houses!
Sound there from the 1968 film version of Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare's star-crossed lovers who die because of a family feud. Except, spoiler alert, the real reason Romeo and Juliet die is a pandemic. There is a class at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. It's called Infected Shakespeare. I love that name. And it will make you rethink a lot about the Bard. Michelle Ephraim teaches Infected Shakespeare and is also the co-author of the cocktail recipe book, wait for it, Shakespeare Not Stirred. Professor Michelle Ephraim joins us now for our next installment of Brilliant Boston. Michelle, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So I'm going to play a little more sound right off the top because this is Shakespeare. So this is Ballygill as Romeo from a Royal Shakespeare Company production, finding what he thinks is Juliet's dead body.
Dear Juliet, why art thou yet so fair? I will stay with thee, and never from this palace of dim night depart again. Here will I set up my everlasting rest. Come, bitter conduct, come and savory guide. Thus, with a kiss, I die.
And he dies. Michelle, it never gets any less heartbreaking. But for those of us who have been out of high school for a little while, maybe literally remind us what's happening. Why does he think she's dead? Why does he die?
Right. Well, I always tell my class, actually, I ask them at the beginning of class, how did Romeo and Juliet die? And they say, duh, you know, double suicide. The plan for these star-crossed lovers is for Juliet to take a potion given to her by Friar Lawrence that will make her seem dead. So her banished lover, Romeo, is meant to find her in the Capulet family tomb and say, yay, you're alive, and we're going to run off and be happy together. However, he does not get the message, literally does not get the message, and he thinks she's dead. So he kills himself, she wakes up, she kills herself, and that is the end of the story.
And I do want to note, I always do this, we're going to have fun with this segment. We're going to talk about some amazing stuff, but we did just talk about dying by suicide, two people dying by suicide. Before the end of the segment, I'll put up for listeners, I'll make sure to give you the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. But for those of you for whom this is painful, we're going to go on now into this subject, and we're going to be a little bit playful for it, with it. So I just want to be mindful of our listeners. Oh, and Amanda reminds me, actually 988 is a very rememberable number. That's the new mental health hotline number that's nationwide. If you need support, dial 988. Okay, so we're going to step away from that because we want to come back to what you're teaching in your class, Professor Michelle Ephraim, which is that actually that's not practically what happened. Practically what happened is they died because of the plague. Explain that a little bit.
Yes. So I always explain that to my students. They died because of the plague. Friar Lawrence gives his fellow friar, Friar John, a letter to take to Romeo, who has gone to Mantua, which is the neighboring town, to explain this to him. And Friar John doesn't get there. He doesn't get there because he's stopped by people who are employed to police the streets to make sure that people who are infected or who have come into close contact with someone infected do not travel around.
Okay, so you've got a little bit for us to read here. I get to read Shakespeare with you.
Absolutely.
But I'm giving you the hard stuff. So we're going to read a little of this. I'm going to be Friar Lawrence and you're going to be Friar John. So, welcome from Mantua. What says Romeo? Or, if his mind be writ, give me his letter.
Going to find a barefoot brother out, one of our order, to associate me, here in this city, remember that line, here in this city, visiting the sick, and finding him, the searchers of the town, suspecting that we both were in a house where the infectious pestilence did reign, sealed up the doors and would not let us forth, so that my speed to Mantua there was stayed.
Okay, so iambic pentameter, not easy to follow on the radio, just literally what did Friar John just say?
He said, well, I was going to travel with another friar, which was, very typical. And that guy was visiting someone who was in an infected house, so with people or a person who was infected with the plague. And then the searchers, who, again, are employed to police this kind of situation, once they saw Friar John and the other friar, they were aware that they had had contact with someone who was infected, and they made sure that they didn't travel anywhere. This may sound familiar to people. So he could not get to Mantua.
All right, so let's read a little bit more. So I'm again Friar Lawrence, you're Friar John. Who bear my letter then to Romeo?
I could not send it. Here it is again. Nor get a messenger to bring it thee. So fearful were they of infection.
Unhappy fortune, where the infectious pestilence did reign, sealed up the doors, so fearful were they of infection. I feel like I got kind of the cool line there. Sorry about that. But now I hear it. And you explain this, right? You do it better. So explain the exchange we just heard.
Right. So Friar Lawrence is saying with great trepidation, I imagine Shakespeare could have put a lot of ums in here. bear my letter, and he says, oh, no, it actually never got there. In fact, here it is. And no one else sent it either because there was so much fear of infection. Yeah. So it didn't get to Romeo. And one thing I want to point out, too, is that Shakespeare deviates from his sources for Romeo and Juliet. And his source material, they have the plague raging in Mantua. In Romeo and Juliet, the implication, and actually the clear reference to the plague in Verona, here in this city is the line. So Shakespeare has the plague going on in Verona, not in the neighboring
town.
Because
it's dramatically helpful to do so.
Well, it's dramatically helpful, and also people could relate that he was writing Romeo and Juliet right after they'd gotten, sort of on the other end of a major plague outbreak. So this was very familiar to his audience, unfortunately.
So we're speaking with Associate Professor Michelle Ephraim, who's at Worcester Polytechnic Institute and teaches a very popular class called Infected Shakespeare. I want to pick up a little bit more on that. It's not only there in Romeo and let me back up. I've got this sound I'm excited to get to, and I was about to throw to it, but I realize I got one more thing I want to pick up here first. I learned that Shakespeare's birth and upbringing was affected by the plague.
Oh, yes. I mean, plague outbreaks punctuated his entire life. From the moment he was born through his death, I mean, there was plague outbreaks constantly. There were overall at least 17 outbreaks in England between 1500 and 1665. There was one starting in 1563. He was born in 1564. Another one in 1592, just as he had started to make it in London.
So bam, bam, bam.
Bam, bam, bam. Exactly. Yeah. Over and over again, a relentlessness.
And so that gives me a chance to play this other sound that I wanted to. See, he kind of goes at it indirectly or, mm-hmm. or coyly or slyly, just to illustrate for people how it was threading through art at the time. This yes. is a poem, A Litany of Time and Plague. It's by a contemporary of Shakespeare's, Thomas Nash, and it's read by Tom O'Bedlam.
Rich men trust not in wealth, gold cannot buy you health. Physic himself must fade, all things to end are made. The plague full swift goes by, I am sick, I must die. Lord, have mercy on us.
Now, Michelle, that sits in my gut after yeah. what we've lived through these last couple of years. Yes. What is it like to teach this class now?
Oh, well, I actually was teaching this class before the pandemic. I taught it last time in the fall of 2020 over Zoom. And I usually begin the segment on pandemics, plagues, by saying, imagine, you know, with the goal of creating a suspension of disbelief. Imagine what it would be like. Well, I can
As
cut that segment
fiction.
Out. Right. Well, just it's something that we can't imagine. Now we can, unfortunately. There were so many themes, so many uncanny moments in the class, and it was really, I mean, it was chilling and wonderful to experience that with the students. I mean, for me to look at these documents written in the 16th and 17th centuries through the eyes of someone who now understood pandemics from firsthand experience, to experience that alongside the students was really amazing. For example, reading about class divides, reading about how the poor were demonized, reading about wealthy people fleeing to their expensive vacation homes. But yeah, class divisions. Students were very, very passionate about talking about these issues normally, and even more so because it hit so close to home.
So hearing you say that, I guess I want to ask you, did it make you angry? That, I mean, this is knowable stuff from hundreds of years ago
right.
that had come forward not only in history, but as you're showing us, in one of the most famous playwrights, if not the most famous writer
right.
of the Western world.
I mean, you know, I'm a big Shakespeare fan, so nothing he does really makes me angry. But I will say I had a new appreciation of Shakespeare.
No, I mean, does it make you angry that we're here again when all of that history is there?
Well, right. Well, this is sort of what I'm getting to, is that I felt like in Shakespeare there was something optimistic. There was something about resilience that was helpful for me, and I like to think it was helpful for my students as well. To think about what his life must have been like, you know, with all these plague outbreaks, with losing his son. Mm. We don't know that his son died from the plague. We don't know how he died. But so much loss at a period of time where there was so much loss, and that here he kept writing. And there's so many references to plagues, contagion in Shakespeare's work that are metaphoric. He's not saying, oh, the plague outbreak, and referencing it directly, but he is writing a lot about contagion. And one of the things I talked to the students about was how he pivoted artistically, that he was almost reclaiming the incidents of the plague and the loss that everyone around him had experienced, and turning that into art by way of metaphor.
So there was another aspect, and I'm going to tell listeners now, we're going to get a little bawdy here for these last couple of minutes. But there was another aspect, which was, you know, this class you're teaching, Michelle Ephraim from Worcester Polytechnic Institute, is called Infected Shakespeare. So I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but this will be fun to see if you recognize right away where I'm going. So here is the sound.
Oh, no. What's the news with you?
Yonder man is carried to prison.
Well, what has he done?
A woman.
But what is his offense?
Groping for trouts in a peculiar river.
A lot of not-so-subtle entendre there. Paige Clements as Mistress Overdone and Lisa Barnes as her employee Pompey. And that's from a 2022 reading sponsored by History Alive of
Measure for Measure.
And tell me why this one's in your class.
Oh, well, it is all about infection. It is about, it's set in Vienna, and it's about a very corrupt society where all kinds of sexual indiscretions are going on left and right, and there's sort of a running subplot about a house of prostitution, but it eventually, if you will, sort of makes its way infection-like into the main plot as well.
I think we have a little bit of that. So here I'm going to play Act 2, Scene 1, right where the bumbling constable, Elbow, apprehends the character Pompey, who works for Mistress Overdone at this house that you're talking about. And this is performed by actor Vincent Bagnall.
He, sir, a tapster, sir, parcel board. One that serves a bad woman, whose house was, as they say, plucked down in the suburbs. And now she professes a hothouse, which I think is a very ill house, too.
So was Shakespeare essentially using I don't know that this is the correct word for a sexually transmitted infection, but a pestilence of some kind as a metaphor for other things that eat away at our structures and ourselves?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And Measure for Measure, which was written in the early 17th century, was very much connected to, long experience of plague outbreaks, syphilis outbreaks. So again, Shakespeare is using this to refer to actual medical happenings around him. Syphilis was a epidemic in London at this time.
So how did people find it funny?
one of the things I was going to say before, in all of Shakespeare's plays, whether they're categorized as tragedies or comedies, you have tragic and comic elements. Like, I find Romeo hilarious. He's and the fact that he's whining and groaning about being dumped by a woman makes it even, it's even more ridiculous than the fact that there's a plague going on. It's like, dude, what are you doing? So why is this funny? Well, Shakespeare makes it funny. I think there's something therapeutic about conveying it in this way for his audience. Absolutely.
All right. So listen, I wish we could take the whole class. That is Michelle Ephraim, who's a professor, associate professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. She's co-author of the book Shakespeare Not Stirred and teaches Infected Shakespeare. Fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
Yep, it's Cristela time as we head into another, let's call it, balmy weekend. WBUR senior arts and culture reporter Cristela Guerra, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
I love it when it's Cristela time, and we're going to dive right in today. We do enjoy having fun on the weekends, but it's interesting to me, this week, you can actually start us with something that's fun, but also ties directly into a pretty big policy story from the week. So let's hit the policy part first.
When you're wearing your hair in any state, in any form, especially naturally, and you're told, no, it's not acceptable, you have to leave, you can't have it, it really is a personal attack. And to know that that can no longer happen in the state of Massachusetts is such a win.
Now, people who play the WBUR News Quiz probably already know what this is about, but for the rest, Cristela, tell us who that was and what's been going on.
So that sound was Deanna Cook, one of two sisters who in 2017 was punished by their charter school in Malden for wearing hair extensions. They advocated for change, and 3 days ago, this past Tuesday, Governor Charlie Baker signed into law what's known as the Crown Act. It prohibits denying someone a job, opportunities, educational opportunities based on hairstyle or hair texture. So we're talking afros, cornrows, braids, twists.
And theirs has not been the only story of discrimination based on hair, especially black hair. And now there is a play about that.
Absolutely, yeah. It's called Can I Touch It? That's the production by Francisca da Silveira, a Cape Verdean American playwright. She's from Boston. And it refers to a question many black women have been asked about their hair inappropriately in most cases, in all cases, but obviously like in situations where they're not even expecting it, basically. It looks at black hair politics, the racism faced by black business owners in Boston, and it's at the Strand in Dorchester, which is a gorgeous theater. And it's pay what you can. So if that's zero, then pay zero. We're talking it's Friday and Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday at 2, and it's until August 13th.
All right. So we're going to go from the serious to the silly now, but also sort of echoes headlines. Tell us about this one.
Serious to the absurd.
Yeah.
So there are those dear friends of mine who know it is Shark Week. It's a week-long program dedicated to sharks. It's a tradition on the Discovery Channel that I love. It goes back to the late 80s. And it's a part of conservation efforts. So they're showing Sharknado at the New England Aquarium.
Okay.
And here's a scene from the movie.
It's really even raining.
It's flooding here. And not the plumbing, the ocean. You need to go home.
I'm not going anywhere.
Storm's coming and it's coming fast.
Not kidding, folks. A tornado full of sharks. Tell us more about the movie screening.
a storm causes man-eating sharks to fly, drop. You know, I'm from Florida. We know hurricanes.
Hurtle.
propel into L.A. And a group of friends are trying to make it. The problem is that sharks eating people is a misconception that Shark Week is trying to address. But Hollywood. So it's at the Simmons Theater inside the New England Aquarium, Saturday night, 7 p.m., $5.
And let me make it very clear. The $5 is because you get to do it in the New England Aquarium, because I'm not sure I'd pay $5. For Sharknado. Okay, let's do something family friendly here at the ICA. Tell me.
Oh, I love the watershed. So there's a play date. It's a family day. Art making, sweet treats, live music. And the exhibition right now, it looks like it's called Revival Materials and Monumental Forms, Reclaiming Industrial Materials to Create Something New. This is in Eastie. It's from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, and it is free. And for those who are really excited to take the water shuttle, they can't on Saturday. It is officially sold out.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. All right, so you've got one more going on in Boston for us. This one's in Alston, tell me.
It is in Rat City, and this is the Rat City Arts Festival, which highlights artists in that neighborhood. Again, food, music, beverages. And it's at Zone 3, which is an outdoor space that the community uses for events like this, on Western Ave in Alston from 5 to 10 p.m. Saturday, also free admission.
And we've got a little music from the Rat City Art Festival?
We do. So it's Louis M., a Boston-based poet, beatmaker, MC, actually from Rhode Island, from Providence. And he's performed at venues like the Apollo Theater in New York and the Smithsonian. We've got a sample of his music.
All right, and so take us out outside the city, 15 seconds or so. If you want to be somewhere other than Boston this weekend, what you got?
You have to go to Worcester. Saturday, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. for the 7th Annual Gospel Music Fest. It's at the City Hall Common, 455 Main Street. It is free, and honestly, I think it's going to be gorgeous.
Oh, fantastic. All right, that is WBUR Senior Arts and Culture Reporter Cristela Guerra for our Ladies and Gentlemen the Weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Saying goodbye today to Maya Schwader, who's been working with us for the last few months. Maya, we love you. Godspeed on your next adventure. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.